welcome to Mayday, your flight podcast about everything you do not want to happen on your plane. I'm your host, Caroline Miller, and today we are starting our at least two-part series on the Andes flight disaster, aka the miracle of the Andes, aka the Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571, aka the flight that started off like any other flight and ended with survival cannibalism. With me today is Alex Quintero. Alex, welcome back. Oh man, his face made a very shocking expression when I said survival cannibalism.
Hey everybody, it's Alex. Great to be here with you all. Thank you very much, Caroline, for inviting me to listen to cannibalism. And before you all should know, before we started recording, Caroline's like, hey, so Alex, you might know what this one is. And once I start talking about it, that might ring some bells. And I was like, all right, well, I don't think this sounds familiar. So yeah, I didn't know we'd be talking about cannibalism today. I thought this was about planes. So all right, let's get it going.
Oh, it's about both. You know, Alex, we have had a solid month on May Day of funny, haha, feel good stories. Like, you know, we did a 3-part series on DB Cooper. And then last week we did an episode on British Airways Flight 009, where everybody escaped without a scratch. And that was a nice break. But today we start a story that will make you never want to complain about anything ever again. Like last week, I was all bent out of shape because I couldn't get overnight shipping at the post office. And I was like, can I get this overnighted? And the lady was like, no, you can't. It's going to take until March 1st. And I was like, and I was all bent out of shape. But after doing days of research on this, I'm never complaining again, ever.
Nothing worse than aviation cannibalism.
Literally nothing worse. So Alex, crazy. Sounds like, so is this ringing any bells? Are you familiar with this?
Not at all. No, I've never heard of this one.
Okay, perfect. So all of the shock is going to be completely raw and uncut. I'm sure a lot of listeners right now are probably saying like, oh, I know this, because not only was this a big news story at the time, it was in 1972, but they also made a movie about it, which I'm sure a number of people have seen, and I think there's a number of documentaries on it as well. I cannot bring myself to watch visual representations of this story for reasons that will become immensely clear, and horror movies are my favorite genre, so that says a lot. Speaking of which, full-blown heads up, this series is, it's going to be brutal. It's going to definitely be the roughest thing that we've covered on this podcast so far, and I'll give warnings before particularly difficult moments in the story, but just so you know, this is going to be, to put it very lightly, rough. So, enough preamble. Are you ready to get into
it? We're ready!
Woo! So, Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571 was a chartered flight from Montevideo, Uruguay, to Santiago, Chile. The aircraft was a small 4-year-old turboprop Fairchild FH-227D, and the plane only had 279 flight hours. Why was this plane being chartered? Well, the plane's occupants were 45 people. There were 40 passengers and 5 crew members. Most of the people on board were members of the Old Christians Club rugby union team from Montevideo, Uruguay, who were on their way to play a match in Chile against the Old Boys Club, which is also a rugby team. So they're on a rugby adventure. And I don't know why all the teams are, they all have old at the beginning. It's the Old Christians Club versus the Old Boys Club. But everybody here is young, like they're all in their late teens to early 20s. So do you know why this is? Write in at maydaymaydaypod@gmail.com and tell me why, because I don't know. But there were actually only 19 of the rugby team members on the plane. The rest of the 40 passengers were actually family and friends, and originally there were 10 empty seats left on the plane with their initial invitees taken into account. And so it was like, we have the rugby team, and then we have their first pick of family and friends, but there's still 10 seats left. And so then people tap, like, you know, their secondary backup friends, like, hey, do you want to come to Chile and watch me play rugby? And so then they filled up the rest of the plane, and it's a totally full plane. And one person at the last second was like, actually, I can't make it. which led one woman named Graziella Mariani to buy the seat because she just needed to make it to her daughter's wedding. And so she's the only person on the plane that is not related to the rugby team, and she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So let's get into the crew. We have an experienced captain. His name is Colonel Julio Cesar Ferradas, and he was a decorated Air Force pilot with 5,117 flight hours. His less than competent co-pilot was named Lieutenant Colonel Dante Hector Lagurada. And due to the nature of what is about to happen to these people, we will get into the fates of each individual passenger and crew member as we go. So, the plane took off from Carrasco International Airport on October 12, 1972, but the flight was short-lived. This was not because they crashed on this initial flight, but it was actually because there was a treacherous storm hammering the Andes, and they had to cross the Andes to get to where they were going, so they had to do an unscheduled overnight stop in Mendoza, Argentina. Everybody woke up on Friday the 13th, and they were like, let's try again! I'm sure it's gonna go much better this time. But unbeknownst to any of them, today was going to go much, 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 much worse than the day before. The flight was delayed once again due to the continuing storm conditions over the Andes, and, you know, the captain, erring on the side of caution, just said, let's wait until the storm is either 100% gone or it's just clouds that don't really have anything cooking in them, because we want to make sure that this area is safe to fly through, because I'm the captain. And I'm thinking about this, and I want people to be safe. And especially since flying through the Andes in a small aircraft is more difficult than flying with a standard commercial plane, because the smaller plane has lower maximum altitude limits. So most commercial planes can fly up to, you know, 42,000 feet or so if they really need to. But this small plane only had a ceiling of 28,000 feet. And this limitation is not great because some of the Andes mountains, particularly the ones that they would cross if they took the direct route, some of those mountains were 26,000 feet. And that's too close for comfort for the captain because, again, the captain of this flight wants everybody to be okay. Alex is pointing to his brain.
It sounds like big brain decisions are being made. I like this captain. Safety first, always.
Yeah, exactly. I like the captain too. Safety first, always. He's being cautious. And so he says, let's not do the direct route, even though it would be faster. Let's just take the longer route. It's going to take 90 minutes. But what we're going to do to be safe is we are going to fly south and then cross the shorter mountains and then fly back up to Santiago. So this flight path started in Mendoza. Again, they fly south to Malargue, and then they turn west and they cross the Planchon to Chile's Curacho radio beacon. And then after they cross into Chile across the mountains, they were going to turn right, fly back up north to Santiago, and land. And that was the plan, but it didn't happen because at 2:18 p.m. on Friday the 13th of October 1972, Friday the 13th is bad. Uruguayan Air Force Flight 571 took off from Mendoza, Argentina. The 90-minute flight turned into a nightmare that for some would actually last 72 days. Yeah, some of these people lived for 72 days after this crash in the Andes Mountains with no regular food and no regular water and no plants and no animals. It's gonna get crazy. So everything started off normally. Co-pilot Hector Lagurada was flying the aircraft and he flew south from Mendoza to Malargue at 18,000 feet or 5,500 meters. And at this point, he gets in touch with ATC and tells them, you know, in essence, hey, we're going to reach Planchon Pass at about 3:21 p.m. And this was a critical communication because Planchon Pass is the handoff between Argentinian ATC and Chilean ATC. But unfortunately, this is where things start to get a little out of hand. Remember our experienced captain who is, you know, making big brain decisions and trying to keep everybody safe, Colonel Ferradas? He had actually flown across the Andes 29 times, so he's experienced. But he's not flying the plane today. Why? Well, this flight is a training flight for First Officer Hector, who is therefore flying the plane this fateful day. But don't worry. The weather is great, and it's just wonderful conditions for this training flight. Just kidding, I just lied to you. The conditions were bad. The cloud cover was incredibly dense, and the plane was totally surrounded by clouds. Like, you know when you're in a plane, and you're like, I can see things, and then you enter a cloud, and you're like, everything is white, and I don't know where I am. It was like that all the time. This meant that the pilots had to solely rely on their radio navigation systems, which is going to become very important in a moment. Once the plane reached Planchon Pass, they still had a solid 40 miles or 65 kilometers until they were going to reach Curaçao, but First Officer Hector apparently did not remember this, or he just thought the information was wrong, because at 3:21 p.m. he told air traffic control that they were actually going to get to Curaçao in under a minute. And it's worth noting at this point that it should take 11 minutes to get from where they were to Curaçao, not one. And so 3 minutes later, in addition, the first officer got in contact with ATC again. And after turning 11 minutes prematurely, he says, okay, we're passing Curaçao and turning north. Can I make a descent now? And air traffic control, who apparently was also not paying a lick of attention at all, said, yeah, sure. I trust that you're totally in control of the situation. Descend. Knock yourself out. So let's take a second before the events happen right now to put on our thinking caps so we can visualize where the plane is. From a bird's eye view, the plane is supposed to go south along the edge of the Andes, turn to the west to go over the little mountains at the bottom part of the Andes, and then turn right and go back up north to get to Santiago and land. But what's happened is that they have gone south, and they've turned west, but they haven't flown far enough west to actually clear the mountains. So they've just turned, and they're heading straight back over the Andes. But the first officer does not realize this, and he thinks that I'm clear of the mountains and it's time for me to descend into Santiago, but he's actually just descending straight into the most remote area of the Andes. And because air traffic control isn't paying attention, nobody is correcting him and saying, hey, where the hell are you going? And the cloud coverage makes it so that he has no visual indicator of where he is, and he's just making a series of bad navigational errors, so he's not even interpreting the information that the plane is giving him correctly. And he turned at the wrong heading. He turns at a heading of 014 degrees when he was supposed to have turned at a heading of 030 degrees. Turbulence starts, because that's what happens when you fly close over a mountain, as the plane is just... Alex has raised his hand. Yes.
Question, Your Honor. Where is the captain during this whole thing?
Apparently, he's just chilling out. He does not correct anything. Like, I didn't read anywhere what in the world the captain was doing during this time, because he should have known better.
Well, yeah, if it's a training flight, it means he's supposed to be on the flight deck also, like, watching everything.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. He should be on the flight deck watching everything. And making sure that, you know, we don't fly into the goddamn Andes.
Yeah. Crazy.
He should know that the first officer is probably going to make a mistake because he's in training.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, that's when you were saying, it's like, first officer this, first officer did that, then the first officer did that. I'm like, but where's the captain?
He took a nap. Just kidding. I don't think so.
It's also interesting for anyone that's heard any of the sessions that I've been on in the past, which has only been like two, ATC knowledge. So on an ATC scope, I don't know about the 70s, but at least in the modern day, and maybe this is a result of these sort of things, but at least in the modern day, usually ATC scopes have little objects on their scopes, like little half triangle sort of things that designate like where mountains are. They're usually like line markings or something like that that will tell you where important geographical things, landmarks or structures are located. Like, so for example, if you're flying to LAX, there are mountains to the north in Hollywood Hills. So on an ATC scope, you'll have like little half triangles in a line that tell the ATC, hey, there are mountains here. So be
careful.
They're
pointy. Like they're these pointy. Triangles.
Be very careful about telling people to go there. Right? And there's a lot of training. So it's very interesting that nobody is paying any attention. The captain's taking a nap. The first officer is making mistakes because he's not paying. Well, he also is inexperienced, but he's not really paying the best attention. And air traffic control isn't paying attention. So it seems like everyone's a big fail here so far, which is very, very sad.
Yes, everybody is dropping the ball completely. We will see how ironic everything is in terms of like who has the worst time after the crash and who has like the most merciful time. Obviously, ATC is not involved in the crash, so they just sat at home and were like, well, I fucked up that really bad. And, you know, they probably lived with the guilt for the rest of their life, which is punishment in and of itself. But the fate of the crew is very ironic, and we'll get into that in just a few minutes. But yeah, I totally agree with everything you're saying. It is so weird that ATC is just like, yeah, do it. Fly into the triangles. That
looks
great.
Do it. You won't. Try it.
You're just going on an adventure. Do it. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And I'm laughing now because this is the only time I can laugh for the next, like, I don't even know how long. So, back to the plane. It's bumpy. It's turbulent. It's very turbulent. One of the survivors, Nando Parado, later said that the plane was dropping by what felt like hundreds of feet at a time. And he said that people were kind of nervously joking about it until they broke through the floor of the clouds and they saw a big black mountain that they were about to crash straight into. In the cockpit, the first officer was like, uh-oh. And so he decides that he is going to try to clear the mountain by applying maximum thrust to the engines. And he just puts the nose up as hard as he can. And he just tries to like rocket over it to see if they can just clear it. Another survivor named Roberto Canessa later said that the passengers could all hear the ground collision alarm. And so everybody knows like, okay, this is, we're going to crash because the plane says we're going to crash. We are fucked. The plane goes nearly vertical because of everything that the first officer is doing. And it actually went so far vertical so quickly that it almost stalled. And the nose did successfully clear the top of the ridge, but at 3:34 p.m., the tail cone clipped the ridge of the mountain and the plane veered out of control. The right wing was torn off because it hit another peak of the mountain and the wing flew backwards. And when the wing was ripped off of the plane, it crashed into the tail section of the plane. It ripped off the tail, the vertical stabilizer, and both horizontal stabilizers. And with that, it sucked out three passengers, a flight attendant, the flight navigator, the entire galley area, and the baggage compartment. So the people who died at this moment on day one were Lieutenant Ramon Sal Martinez, Orvido Ramirez, who was a flight attendant, Gaston Costamale, Alejo Jauni, Guido Magri, Daniel Shaw, and Carlos Valletta. And all of them died instantly except for Carlos, who survived his initial fall, but then he got up and tried to walk, and he fell down the glacier, and then he got sucked into a massive snow drift, and he suffocated in the snow and died.
Wow.
This was the first group of people to die. People die in groups as the story progresses. So the remaining people on board were now trapped in a plane that literally had a gaping hole in the back of it. The severed plane, which only has one wing, flew for another 660 feet or 200 meters until the left wing crashed into another part of the mountain, and that wing was torn from the plane and one of the propellers detached and cut through the passenger cabin. At this point, two more people were sucked out of the plane, and missing both wings and the entire back half of the plane, the main body slammed into the ground and skidded down a glacial mountain face like a cursed toboggan for 2,379 feet or 725 meters until it crashed into a snowbank. The force of the collision ripped all of the seats from their bearings and threw all of them into the front of the plane. And they're all in their seats. So at this point, a ton of people break their legs. Some people die. One of the people that died instantly was the captain because the control panel crushed his chest and his head broke through the cockpit windscreen. So the plane has come to a stop, and everything was still, and the survivors were now trapped on a glacier in the Andes. This was located in the Mendoza province. The elevation of where they were was 11,710 feet. The area is remote, unpopulated, completely inhospitable, and at that point, the glacier didn't have a name, but after everything that was going to happen on it over the next 72 days, it was later named Glaciar de las Lagrimas, or in English, the Glacier of Tears. Yeah.
I would cry too.
I thought so much about what I would do if I was in this situation. I don't know what I would do. I want to think that I would be brave, but I think I would will myself to die.
So, yeah, like half of me would feel like, okay, well, ATC saw us go down, so they know where we are. They'll send help. I'll be fine.
Even though they were completely incompetent the first time.
Yes, they were. But, you know, maybe they got an alert or something. They know where we are. And then the other half of me is, you know, even if they find out where roughly we are, I'm not going to be able to eat anything. I'm not going to be able to do anything. It's uninhabitable. It's like an icy desert. There's nothing for miles. I'll never get out of here.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know. I would probably be sad I wasn't one of the people that just died. Oh, I feel like it would be the, you know, most like direct thought I would have. Like, wow, there's no way I'm getting out of here. Why couldn't it have been me who died?
Right? I imagine that a lot of people who lived were like, I wish I had just died instantly. This is something that, you know, kind of happens. Like, this is a nightmare that you would have. And you're like, I have to wake up. Like, I have to wake up. This is crazy. This doesn't happen to people. This is a nightmare. But this was actually really happening to these people. And they are, most of them are between 18 and 25. I think the median age of the rugby players was like 21. And, you know, this is the time in your life when you're supposed to be partying and having fun and, like, adventuring. This is not the time in your life when you're supposed to crash on your way to a rugby match and have unspeakable atrocities happen to you for the next 72 days, or you die. It's insane. So the survivors, speaking of just what you do, they were kind of taking stock of what just happened, and they realized that the captain is not the only person that is dead. There are four more corpses among the wreckage of the plane at this time. In a very cruel twist of fate, one of the people that was most qualified to help the survivors had himself been killed. This was the team physician, Dr. Francisco Nicola, and his wife, Esther Nicola, were both killed instantly when the plane crashed. Another woman, Eugenia Parado, who was the mom of one of the rugby players, Nando Parado, she was also killed instantly. And a medical student, Fernando Vasquez, was also dead, and he was found nearby.
How's our wedding woman doing? Is she alive?
Is
she alive right now in the story?
She's alive right now.
Okay, that's all I want to know. I'm rooting for her. Let's keep going.
As of right now, it's possible.
It's possible.
She's not going to make it to the wedding on time, but at this point, it's possible.
Okay, I'm rooting for her.
But the miracle here is that most of the people on the plane were still alive. And especially in these small plane crashes, usually the smaller the plane, the more screwed you are because there's less plane to take the blow when you crash. But because the wings and the tail took a lot of the momentum of the crash, and because the plane happened to hit the back of this glacier at roughly the same angle that the glacier was at, it kind of slid down. And if you survived the impact of hitting the snowbank, there was a decent chance you survived. And in fact, 33 of the original 45 people on the plane were still alive at this point. And among them were two medical students named Canessa and Gustavo Zerbino. And they were healthy enough to go around to all the passengers in the aftermath of the crash, and they were helping them as much as they could. And they're treating their wounds to the best of their abilities, but they have no supplies. They're just basically saying, like, okay, let's pull this thing out of your leg and see what happens. Here's my clothes to use as a bandage. Put ice on it. We're surrounded by ice, so that you know, that's a kind of silver lining. The guy whose mother died, Nando Parado, he had massive head trauma, and he actually was in a coma for 3 days. A man named Enrique Platero, he was a 22-year-old member of the rugby team, and he'd studied agriculture, and he had hopes of becoming a dairy farmer one day. He had a piece of metal stuck in his abdomen. heads up, this is one of the parts where it gets really graphic and gross. So if you don't like gore, skip ahead by like 15 seconds. So when one of the surviving medical students removed the scrap of metal, several inches of his intestine fell out. But he was like, I can do this. And so he kind of just shoved it back into his stomach. And then the medical students tied some clothes around the wound. And then Enrique was a super badass. And he's like, my guts just fell out. But you know what? I'm feeling all right enough to go help people. So he just gets up and he starts walking around and he's helping people, even though his guts just fell out. He's amazing. I don't know how he did anything. If that happened to me, I'd just be like, kill me. Please let me die. I just want to die right now.
That's got to be like adrenaline or something. That's crazy.
Oh, of course. It has to be. Like, to do something like that, you have to be running on just like pure adrenaline and shock. Full on, like, this is a dream. This isn't really real mode. Like, that has to be how he got through that. I cannot even imagine. This is why I couldn't watch the movie. I couldn't watch that happen. Even in a movie when it's not real, I couldn't watch it knowing it actually happened to somebody. This brings us to Arturo Nogueira, and he was a 21-year-old team member of the rugby team, and he had been seriously injured when his seat flew forward, and his legs were crushed between his seat and the seat in front of him. And his head and his torso were okay, but his legs were broken in many, many places. And now, you might be wondering, okay, Captain's dead. What happened to the first officer? Well, the guy who, you know, made the most mistakes, and everybody made mistakes, but he made the most to get us in this situation. He was alive in the cockpit, but he was severely injured. He was trapped because, just like the captain, the control panel, like, was crushing his chest, but it hadn't killed him. And he was screaming for somebody to shoot him to put him out of his misery. And the passenger that he was screaming at, like, to begging him to shoot him, the passenger was like, No, that guy just had his guts fall out because of the mistakes you made. So you're gonna die the way you were meant to. And so the survivors chose to let him die slowly in the cockpit in the company of his colleague's corpse, which is brutal. But at the same time, I don't blame them.
And, you know, mistakes happen. Maybe it's I don't know. I feel like I'd still want to help because it's like it was an accident. Like, you didn't mean any of this to happen. I'm still going to help you. At the same time, I can sympathize with you did this to us. Now you will suffer from your own mistake.
Yeah.
You know, this is your fault.
Yeah, everybody else is suffering from your mistake, so you're gonna suffer too.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do see what you mean where it's like, it's not like he meant for this to happen.
Yeah.
So it is, you kind of do feel for him, but at the same time, why should he get the mercy? Any of the passengers could have said, please shoot me. I don't want to be alive anymore. The passenger whose guts fell out could have said, my guts fell out. Please shoot me. But he didn't. Yeah. He just shoved it back inside and went and helped people because he's a badass.
Yes.
And it wasn't his fault. And so I do see how, like, I'm the man who got us in this situation, and I'm in pain. Please shoot me so I cannot be in pain anymore. I can totally understand why the passengers would be like, you know what? No. Nope, you're gonna suffer right with the rest of us. Just like this entire story, it's absolutely brutal, but I understand why it happened. So the plane's loss did not go unnoticed by ATC. They were not incompetent enough to not notice a missing plane. They were good enough at their job to be like, oh, that went away. So once the plane disappeared from the radar, the Chilean Air Search and Rescue Service was notified and they began the search like immediately. A senior officer in the search and rescue organization listened to the radio communications from the plane from before they crashed, and he correctly concluded that the plane had gone down in one of the most remote and inaccessible parts of the Andes. So they searched until the sun went down. Obviously, they didn't find anything. And after the initial search ended at around 6 o'clock p.m., the media was made aware of the plane's disappearance. Now that we've gone over the initial crash, we're going to start organizing the following events by week. Because again, this goes on for 72 days. Each week that passes is more insane than the last. And, you know, a movie was made out of this for a reason, and we will see why. So we will now begin week one. As the first night fell around the surviving passengers, The rugby team captain, named Marcelo Perez, he assumed leadership of the operation, which makes sense because he's the leader of the team. And he's like, okay, everybody's used to me being in a leadership position. We do need somebody to step up here. So I'm just going to do it. So he says, I'm in charge. And everybody says, okay. And there is very limited food. In fact, the only nourishment that they had was the following. They had 8 chocolate bars, 8 with a T, a tin of mussels, 3 small jars of jam, 1 can of almonds, a couple of dates, dried plums, various candies that included chocolate-covered peanuts, and they also had a few bottles of wine. The group decided to very, very sparingly and strictly ration the food and the wine, because at this point they're like, somebody's going to come rescue us, so we can eat this, we just have to eat it very slowly to make sure that we have enough time to be rescued. And then Perez spearheaded an effort to create a shelter within the plane's fuselage, even though the space was only 8 by 11 feet large, which is 2.5 by 3 meters, they were able to kind of cram everybody in the space. They used seats, scraps of the plane, and luggage to close off the hole at the end of the plane where the tail used to be. And with everything as in place as it could be, over 30 people crammed into the tiny shelter. They settled in the plane, and they tried to sleep through the night. However, 5 people would not wake up after this first night. The following people and crew died during the first night. It is 21-year-old rugby team player Francisco Abal, who worked in his family tobacco business, 42-year-old Graziella Mariani, who was the woman who had nothing to do with the rugby team. She just had the bad luck of trying to get to her daughter's wedding, and she died on the first night.
Sad.
It is sad. Damn. It's so sad. I was really rooting for her, because when I first researched this, I didn't know who lived and who died. Mm. And so when I saw, like, oh, and there's this one woman who was just trying to get to her daughter's wedding, I was like, please let her live, but she dies very, very quickly. Which is kind of merciful.
Sure. Do any of these reports say exactly how they died?
The only documentation of this happening is the survivors, and it's very possible that the survivors were too traumatized, or they just don't remember how the people died the first night. Most people probably bled out, or they had some kind of head trauma, or they just froze to death because the temperatures got to negative 22 Fahrenheit or negative 30 Celsius. So they could have just frozen to death, like, in the night. It's totally possible. So she passes away. And then another person that died was 22-year-old rugby player and also a really good poet, Felipe Macarien. There was a 24-year-old team member named Julio Martinez Llamas. And finally, the co-pilot finally succumbed to his injuries and died in the night. At the dawn of the second day, everybody who wakes up, and they realize, okay, there are some people who did not wake up. At this point in our recollection of events, there are, as far as the passengers know, 10 people dead. There's 7 people missing from when the plane ripped apart because they don't know where they went. The survivors don't know that they're dead yet. And there are 28 survivors now. They quickly got to work on the high priority items on their first full day in the Andes, which was getting water, preventing snow blindness, which is where the UV light reflected off of snow literally just blinds your eyeballs. And they also needed to create proper shoes for the snow because a lot of these people were just wearing sneakers. And then they also were creating clothes to shield themselves from the frigid temperatures because, like I said earlier, like, it got super cold at night. You could easily die just from freezing to death. Most of the people on board also, they grew up by the ocean in warm climates in South America. And a lot of these people had never even seen snow before in real life. And none of them had been in this altitude, period. None of them. Fido Strouch, who was another rugby team member, he created a very clever way to collect water. He took sheet metal from underneath the crushed seats, and he put some snow on it, and he placed the sheets in the sun where the snow would slowly melt, and he bent the metal so the water would pour out in kind of like a spout, and they drank all the wine, which, understandable, I would too, but they kept the empty bottles, and so he placed the empty wine bottles underneath this makeshift solar water creation, and so it would just drip straight into the wine bottles. So that's how they collected water, which is pretty genius, especially given the circumstances. And this guy's cleverness does not end there, because he made goggles to protect his eyes from the snow using sun visors from the cockpit that he'd broken into smaller pieces, and he got some wire, and he got a bra strap, and he made goggles, because he's a badass. Like, these people are so inventive and clever. Multiple passengers also had the idea to cut the seat covers away from the seats, because the seat covers were made of wool, and that actually did a pretty good job of keeping them warm, especially at night. As the days passed, the survivors were occasionally tortured by the sight of search and rescue planes and helicopters flying straight over them and not stopping. Why didn't they stop? Well, remember, they're in a glacial area where everything is completely white. And unfortunately, the plane that they crashed in is also white. And from their altitude, for the search and rescue people, they could not see the wreckage, and the people were so small, they just couldn't see it. They couldn't see where they crashed. And so they're like, well, they're not there. And so they actually were passed over by search and rescue planes 3 separate times. And each time they're like screaming and jumping around and trying to get their attention. And at one point they actually grabbed lipstick from luggage and tried to write SOS on the plane, but there obviously wasn't enough lipstick to make that readable from the search and rescue altitude. Nothing worked, but they still had hope. They were like, well, maybe they'll come back and maybe things will melt and they'll be able to see us. On the third day, remember that guy that fell into a coma and his mom is dead? He wakes up from his coma and the people are like, hey, we crashed in the Andes and also your mom died. And oh, your sister, she's critically injured. He wakes up and he's like, I can't even fathom what's going on. And my sister is my only lifeline here. So he takes care of her nonstop for the next 5 days as her health slowly failed. People continued to eat like tiny amounts of food because, again, they're trying their best to ration their like tiny charcuterie boards worth of snacks. In fact, Nando took 3 days to eat one chocolate covered peanut. 3 days. One peanut. That's patience.
That's incredibly impressive. A single peanut. But did you eat anything else? Do you know? There's no way you could survive for 3 days just off of a third of a peanut at a time.
No, he literally survived off of a third of a peanut at a time, which crazy. Is probably, what, 7 calories a day? Something like that.
I don't know. Maybe he had some more fat internally to burn or something. That's crazy. It's like, wow, you just don't eat anything at all at that point.
Yeah.
Just eat the whole peanut on the third day.
Just
I feel like that'd be more good.
Yeah, it's like, I'm going to splurge. I'm going to eat this 2/3 of a peanut today. Oh, boy. So he did that because he was taking rationing very seriously. And this brings us to the end of the first week. Rescue still wasn't coming. And at the end of the first week, the food totally ran out. They are out of food completely. Not even one peanut left to eat. So we are now in week 2. And on the morning of the 8th day, Susana Parado, the sister of Nando, she died. And for the remaining 27 passengers, things were looking very, very bleak. They had no food, like I said, but I cannot emphasize it enough. They had no options here. And in a desperate attempt, they actually tried eating parts of the plane, like the leather and the cotton from the inside of the seats. And as you can imagine, this just made everybody violently ill. And then on day 11, all of the scavenging from inside the plane, trying to find parts of the plane that they could eat, that actually led the survivors to find a small transistor radio that was stuck between some of the seats. And they turned it on, and a passenger named Roy Harley was like, I can make this radio work. I can make an antenna. And they were like, okay, Roy, try your best. And he actually made a successful antenna that worked out of an electrical wire. And I'm like, how are all of these people suddenly like engineers? This is amazing. How do you know this? So like I said, it worked. The radio worked now. And they turned it on. And what did they hear? The very first thing they heard was a radio announcement saying that the search for their plane and them had been called off, and that no one was coming, and that all of them were presumed dead. And just for a little extra kick of horribleness, the announcer said that planes will return in December. Again, it is October. They said planes will return in December to collect the corpses. And that's the first thing they hear after finding this radio and making it work. And they've been in the Andes for 11 days. Can you imagine surviving in the mountains for 11 days and you've been eating a peanut over 3 days and you find a radio and the first thing you hear is that no one is looking for you anymore? Like, what do you even do?
I just die. I eat the, you know, I do. I eat a whole peanut and just get out of there. I just be like, I'm done. There's no way.
Yeah, I would probably at that point, already just decided it was time to will myself to death, I would just decide at that point that it was time to will myself to death.
Yeah.
But that's not what these people did, because these people are all amazing, inspirational people, and I don't know where they came from. I didn't know that this was the rugby team made of actual superheroes. So here's an excerpt from a book that British author Piers Paul Reid wrote, and it's titled, quote, Alive, colon, the story of the Andes survivors. And it describes the moment where they heard this news. And I thought that this was just a really good summation of what happened. So here it is. Quote, the others who had clustered around Roy upon hearing the news began to sob and pray, all except Nando Parado, who looked calmly up at the mountains which rose to the west. Gustavo Nikolic came out of the aircraft and, seeing their faces, knew what they had heard. He climbed through the hole in the wall of suitcases and rugby shirts, crouched at the mouth of the dim tunnel, and looked at the mournful faces which were turned toward him. Hey, boys, he shouted. There's some good news. We just heard on the radio. They've called off the search. And inside the crowded aircraft, there was silence. As the hopelessness of their predicament enveloped them, they wept. Why the hell is that good news? Pays shouted. Because it means, he said, that we're going to get out of here on our own. The courage of this one boy prevented a flood of total despair. End quote. That is amazing that he even was able to spin that into something good, because what he's basically saying is like, yeah, we can take full credit for rescuing ourselves. Isn't this great?
I guess that's one way to look at it. Like, I'm assuming there's some way out of here. Like, they just got to get to the bottom of the mountain. Or, I mean, I don't know. I'm not familiar with the Andes. But sure, now we can take full control of the situation. We don't have to stay at the plane anymore. We can start to explore and maybe go down to the bottom of the mountain where it's more habitable and maybe there will be animals.
Yeah.
So I can understand that point of view.
Because you're right. There does have to be some kind of way to find at least an area where they can like stone an animal to death and eat it, like at the very least.
Sure.
It's also worth reminding everybody at this point that when the author says, quote, the courage of this one boy, they really are boys. Most of these guys are between 19 and 22. And I want everybody listening to this podcast right now to think about what you were doing with your life when you were 21. So now, put your 21-year-old self in the middle of a remote mountain range with no food, scores of corpses, no one is looking for you, the snow is trying to blind you, and every night you go to sleep and you might not wake up. And this guy right here, is like, it's all good. We'll get out of here. It's amazing. After the initial shock of receiving the news, the survivors were faced with a new predicament, which was, with no hope of rescue for months, they were going to have to figure out food. There were no plants, no animals, like we already said. They already tried eating the plane, and that didn't work. All the food they brought with them was gone, but what they could eat was the preserved corpses of their friends and family. And that's when the cannibalism started. And we will pick up part two of our series on the Andes flight disaster next week, where we will cover the grisly realities of survival cannibalism, an unforeseen and horrific natural disaster that befalls the survivors, and, in the face of it all, unfathomable optimism and bravery that ultimately leads to a miracle. Alex, what are your thoughts?
Pretty incredible story so far. Just a perfect storm of terrible things to happen due to negligence. Yeah, I guess just a series of bad weather conditions and negligence. And I'm so sad Wedding Woman died. She was my hero. I was hoping she'd be the one, you know, like symbolism. She's the one person that wasn't supposed to be there. And she's the one leader they had or something like that, you know.
I know. So it made me sad.
Yeah,
Graziella.
What do you want me to describe?
She was so beautiful. I looked up pictures of her and she was a beautiful woman. She was so smiley and so happy. When you can, like, and by you, I mean, if you want to, Alex, you can. But listeners, if you have the time, look up pictures of all these people because they were all just so beautiful. And so it just makes me so sad that this happened to them. It is a crazy story. You cannot even imagine what is about to happen because when I did the rest of this research, I was like, really? That happened? Are you fucking kidding me? Really? Like, not the survival cannibalism. That I knew was going to happen. But another thing happens where I'm like, really? Okay, so yes, we will talk about that next week. Alex, thank you for being with me this week. If you guys, listeners, have any stories or corrections or suggestions on anything, feel free to write into maydaymaydaypod@gmail.com. If you like the show, leave a review. And until next time, be safe. If you're an air traffic controller, pay attention. And give your loved ones a big ol' hug. Bye-bye.